Are Americans being misled about the bounty of unconventional oil and gas in the United States? Could a financial bubble stemming from overestimates of America's hydrocarbon fuel capacity burst during the Trump presidency? Who are the different factions at war within the American deep state? Where does peak oil and gas fit in with the presidency of Donald Trump? How is the deep state civil war likely to play out for the president? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we mark the one-year anniversary of the inauguration of America's 45th president by examining some of the factors which permitted and possibly facilitated his election and what they bode for the future. We'll hear from J. David Hughes, fellow with the Post Carbon Institute and author of two reports on the precarious future for U.S.-based hydrocarbon production. Then we'll hear from past guest Mark Rabinowitz, who will revisit some of his comments about the Trump presidency and why he was allowed to attain the highest office in the land. On this week's program, Anniversary of the Trump Presidency, Part 1, Peak Oil and the Deep State. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of January 19th, 2018. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory in the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Syria's air defense forces are ready to react to any Turkish hostile action in Afrin, and the Damascus government will consider the Turkish military operation there as an act of aggression, Deputy Foreign Minister Faisal Mekdad told reporters on January 18th, according to the state-run news agency SANA. Quote, "We warn the Turkish leadership that if they initiate combat operations in the Afrin area, that will be considered an act of aggression by the Turkish army," unquote, the deputy foreign minister said, adding that if a Turkish warplane attacks Syria, it will become a legitimate target. Mekdad continued emphasizing that Afrin and other northern areas of the country currently not under control of Damascus are still the territory of Syria. The statement comes after Turkish top officials have once again announced that Turkish forces are ready to launch a military operation against Kurdish militias in northern Syria, particularly in the area of Afrin. That comes from the article, "Syrian Air Defense Ready to Destroy Turkish Warplanes If They Attack Afrin," Deputy FM, posted January 18th, originally appearing at South Front. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has just unveiled a 100% neocon-approved new U.S. policy for Syria. No more pussyfooting around. We won't abandon our project in Syria like Obama abandoned Libya. Presumably, as the neocon myth goes, on the verge of becoming a new Switzerland after its liberation, only to be thrust back into the mire by Obama's premature withdrawal. President Trump is set to out-neocon the neocons with this foolish and destructive policy. The showman is shown to be nothing but a fraud. That comes from the article, Breaking, Tillerson Unveils New U.S.-Syria Plan, Assad Must Go, by Daniel McAdams, posted January 18th, originally appearing at Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. For those that hoped Trump would bring a more sensible approach to the Western-induced Syrian crisis, it is almost for certain that those hopes have been officially dashed with the revelation of the Trump administration's new policy regarding the SDF, Kurds, a new border force, and the logical partitioning plan that is obviously moving forward. The new plans announced by the United States involve the creation of a border force that is expected to contain around 30,000 personnel to be deployed at the borders controlled by the SDF, or Syria Democratic Forces. The force will be trained by the United States and will contain members from the SDF and YPG, and will see Kurdish members patrolling Kurdish areas while Arab members patrol Arab areas. Naturally, the move has angered Turkey since it is opposed to Kurdish nationalism out of fears that it will inspire Kurdish extremists inside Turkey itself. Russia has also condemned the move, claiming that it will lead to partitioning. That comes from the article, U.S. Creates Kurdish Terrorist Border Force in Syria to Define Borders of Kurdistan, by Brandon Turbeville, posted January 18th, originally appearing at Activist Post. Syrian Deputy Foreign and Expatriates Minister Faisal Miqdad stated that the U.S. Kurdish move, quote, is an attempt to divide Syria and prolong the crisis in the country, unquote. And President Assad had previously claimed that Kurdish and other forces who cooperate with the Americans are, quote-unquote, traitors. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov told reporters during a large press conference that, quote, this causes serious questions concerning the maintenance of Syria's territorial integrity, unquote, though reaffirming that the Kurds are still an integral part of the Syrian nation and will nevertheless be represented in some capacity or another at the upcoming Sochi summit at the end of the month. The U.S. is coy about its true intentions in building up a massive force that's expected to be almost 50% larger than its own border patrol at home and deployed along the much geographically smaller area of the Turkish border and the so-called deconfliction line with the Syrian Arab army in the Euphrates River Valley, but some observers are seriously concerned that Washington is trying to transform his anti-terrorist militia into a competent anti-state conventional fighting force, pointing to the large amount of weapons and equipment that they've received over the past couple of years. Most alarmingly, however, and in a move that could have confirmed these suspicions, reports have recently piled in that the U.S. secretly gave MANPAD anti-air missiles to the Kurds, which, if true, would prove that they're indeed capable of becoming an anti-state threat, whether to the Syrians, the Turks, or possibly even the Russians. The Kurdish issue thus risks becoming the first post-Daesh crisis in Syria for this very reason, made all the more urgently important because of Turkey's threats to eliminate the problem before it matures, and all eyes are on President Erdogan to see if he'll make a move on the northwestern region of Afrin in the 2 weeks prior to the upcoming Sochi summit and inadvertently risk subverting it, which might be exactly what the Americans are trying to tempt him into doing. That comes from the article, Syria's Kurdish-led SDF, Border Force or Terror Army, by Andrew Korybko, posted January 18th, originally appearing at Oriental Review. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. As of Saturday, January 20th, Donald Trump will have served as President of the United States exactly 1 year. The new president has been a controversial one. He has appointed Wall Street and military figures to his cabinet. He has pursued more militarily robust and environmentally retrograde policies, and all while being under siege from elements of America's ruling class, which incorporates figures within the country's intelligence apparatus. For this week and the next, we will be commemorating the anniversary of Trump's inauguration with interviews examining the deep politics behind the Trump presidency and the power struggle now underway, and some of the big picture concerns which are being ignored in the midst of frenetic contemporary political discourse. What is the economic and energy backdrop to the Trump administration? To address this point, we start off with an interview from 1 year ago. J. David Hughes is author of two reports from December of 2016 outlining America's energy picture and the disparities between the actual energy prospects and those promoted by the Energy Information Administration. Hughes is an earth scientist who has studied Canada's energy resources for four decades. He has researched, lectured, and published widely on global energy and sustainability issues. He's a board member of Physicians, Scientists, and Engineers for Health Energy and is a fellow of the Post Carbon Institute. your reports deal specifically with tight oil and gas as opposed to conventional production. Could you explain for our listeners what exactly are you referring to there?
Well, tight oil and shale gas has really been made available by new technology, specifically horizontal drilling and high-volume hydraulic fracturing. You know, previously these rocks were too low permeability to produce oil, and they're in fact the source rocks. You know, so if you look at conventional reservoirs, they're porous and highly permeable, and the oil is essentially migrated out of source rocks into those reservoirs where they were trapped. But now shale gas and tight oil have made accessing the source rocks themselves possible, and that's been a huge development. It's basically turned around what was thought to be a terminal decline in U.S. gas production in 2005 to record levels, and the same thing with tight oil.
Mm-hmm. Now, could you maybe explain when it comes to the production increases and declines, does it stand out significantly from what we've become accustomed to with conventional oil and gas production?
Yes, it does. You know, if you look at individual well declines in shale gas or tight oil, they're typically quite a bit higher than conventional. So typically, you know, a shale gas or tight oil well may decline between 80 and 85% in terms of production in the first 3 years. If you look at the overall field decline of some of these fields, the field decline is made up of, typically the decline rate of an individual well is hyperbolic. So the first 3 years are the steepest decline rates, and then it flattens out after that. And in terms of a field, the field is made up of older wells, which are declining at a slower rate, and new wells, which are declining very quickly. So the typical field decline may be between 30 and 45% per year. So in order to maintain production in one of these plays, you have to basically replace 30 to 45% of production each year by more drilling. So you're really on a drilling treadmill in order to maintain production, let alone increase it.
Mm. Now, overview of the two reports is that the EIA is estimating much higher production in the future. And or higher production in the future than today, even though production, the actual production seems to have been in of the major plays seem to have peaked. Is there any set of specific physical conditions, maybe unexplored or unproven reserves that could? Just kind of theorizing here that could possibly make those estimates viable?
I've looked at them in detail, and in fact, I published a report called Drilling Deeper back in 2014. And in that report, I went through all of these major plays on a county-by-county basis. So I looked at the average productivity of wells by county. And typically what you see in these plays is, you know, some very good counties, and then a lot more much less productive counties. So the good counties are called sweet spots. And typically they have much higher well productivities than the rest. And what's happened, we've had a price collapse, of course, in the price of oil beginning in mid-2014. And a similar collapse in terms of the price of gas. For example, in 2008, the price of gas was over $12 per 1,000 cubic feet. And last year, it was less than $2. So what those low prices resulted in is companies drilling the very best parts of the plays. So they drilled the sweet spots, the highest productivity counties. And they were able to make the economics work somewhat by doing that. However, if you look at these plays, there's only a certain number of places to drill. And what's been happening is we're consuming the best locations now, and we're going to have to move out into the lower quality parts of the reservoir, which is what my projections were based on. The EIA, on the other hand, is projecting some, you know, fabulous production increases in some of these plays, like the Bakken, for example, in North Dakota. And for my work actually studying well productivity and geology by county, I don't really see any basis for that.
Another important detail is that these annual energy outlook projections keep increasing year over year. It's so in 2014, they had a certain, it was a more modest projection to 2040. Then it seems to go up in 2015, and now you've got the most optimistic ever, although it seems to be a more gradual increase before a peak. What do you make of that increasing optimism as you go forward year by year?
That's a good question. I mean, the EIA publishes assumptions for each of those annual energy outlooks, and they published the assumptions document. You know, even though the original report was published in April and the final release in September, they didn't publish the assumptions for those reports until December 21st. So you couldn't really tell. You know, when I wrote those reports, I didn't have the assumptions. But, you know, the assumption for the Bakken, for example, you know, if you look at the Bakken reservoir, there's the middle Bakken, which is a lot of the early production. And then there's the Three Forks formation, which underlies it. And the EIA has assumed a huge proportion of available Three Forks, oil resources, which hasn't been drilled yet. So, you know, that's highly speculative. If it existed, companies would have drilled it. So, you know, my analysis is based on actual drilling results. And, you know, you can see that if you look at the Bakken, there's four counties out of about 15. You know, four counties produce the bulk of the oil. And, you know, the Bakken has been going now for a little over a decade. And if you look at the, you know, of the top four counties, the Mount Rail County is the one that really have produced the most oil up until a couple of years ago. Mackenzie is kind of taking it over. So when I looked at that looked at well productivity over time, you can see that there's been quite a good ramp up in terms of well productivity as a result of technology. So, you know, longer horizontal laterals, more frac stages, more water, more sand injection. And that's increased well productivity quite a bit from about 2011 to 2015. And then it's actually declined since then. So what that tells you is, you know, because there's only a limited number of locations to drill, they're now, even though they have better technology, they're now drilling the holes too close together. So one well is draining parts of the reservoir that the other well is also draining. So well productivity is going down, and they're also moving into lower quality parts of the reservoir in that county. And that's a symptom of what's going to happen in all of the other counties as time goes by. And, you know, when I look at the EIA forecast for the Bakken, and they're forecasting a sharp ramp up, you know, to more than double what the peak was. The peak was in late 2014 in terms of the Bakken, and it's now down close to 20% below peak. They're projecting that the Bakken will be close to double peak production in 2040 and, you know, keep on producing. And, you know, I think that's just an extremely optimistic projection, and I don't really see the well productivity data that's based on.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the Bakken alone represents 1/3 of the tight oil and gas production in the United States, correct?
Exactly. And if you add in the Eagle Ford in South Texas, which is another real big one, I mean, the Eagle Ford was the biggest tight oil play, but it's essentially collapsing right now. Mm-hmm. Those two are half of all U.S. tight oil production.
Okay. Now, I know that you may have seen there was a story just out today as we're having this interview about how the newly elected president, Donald Trump, has just signed executive orders advancing the construction of both the Keystone XL and the Dakota Access Pipeline. I'm wondering if you've got the production rates are in decline. Is it economically viable? Never mind the ecological impacts. Is it economically viable to build these huge pipelines?
Well, those pipelines are going to be transporting tar sands oil. Tar sands oil is expected to grow a certain amount. And it's a totally different beast than, tight oil production, which is obtained from wells. Tar sands comes from mining. And typically a mining project, has a 30 to 40 year life at a constant production rate. So there is no decline. It also comes from in situ, basically steaming the oil out of the rocks, heating the rocks up so that you lower the viscosity and you recover bitumen. So, those projects are also, typically 30 year life at a fairly constant production level. So they're quite different than tight oil in the U.S. A lot of capital investment up front, but they last for a long time. Keystone XL will really expedite transportation of tar sands oil to the U.S. Gulf Coast, which is, one of the largest refinery complexes on the planet, capable of optimally refining heavy oil. So, I don't think that, those pipelines will be used if they're built. A key question is around, if they build Keystone XL, why are they building the Trans Mountain pipeline from Edmonton to Burnaby? Keystone XL and the Line 3 expansion will, in essence, take care of all tar sands production, under the Alberta emissions cap, with about a 13% surplus of pipeline only capacity. Industry is complaining about the fact that right now some of the incremental capacity has to be moved by rail, and rail is more expensive than pipelines. But with Trump's approval of Keystone XL today, and Trudeau's approval of the Line 3 expansion, that adds 1.2 million barrels per day of export capacity. So we don't need Trans Mountain, with tankers coming into Burnaby and so forth.
Well, I'm wondering now, what does that do? Does that offset the pipelines that are specifically focused on tight oil and gas production? Or tight oil production, I should say.
Not really. I think there's going to be enough capacity to go around. The price of oil is back up a bit. I mentioned that declines are wicked in tight oil. So you have to keep drilling. And, the rig count in the U.S. has gone down a lot, and it's starting to come back. So I expect that, the declines that are happening in the Bakken and Eagle Ford will probably stop and maybe plateau. They may, in fact, go up a little bit. But I think that, there's going to be lots of pipeline capacity. And if they build Keystone XL, part of that's going to be empty. But, you know, the bottom line is they won't have to use rail, which is quite a bit more expensive. And, you know, the whole argument for these pipelines is the Canadian oil is being unfairly discounted in the U.S. And I've looked into that in detail, and it's really not true. You know, the fact of the matter is that tar sands oil is a long ways from the U.S. Gulf Coast. It's a long ways from Asia or Europe. So there's significant transportation costs. And there's also a quality discount. You know, it's heavy oil, and typically the quality discount is around $8 a barrel. So the U.S. is not unfairly discounting Canadian oil. We don't need to get it to Asia or Europe. You know, our existing markets will pay top dollar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were, you know, on the international stage, you know, OPEC had cut some of their production a couple of weeks back. And so we're seeing, as you mentioned, an increase in prices now. And so as prices increase, you expect to see more tight oil production being executed. There's more pressure in that direction.
Yeah, to a certain extent. But as I mentioned, the sweet spots are being drilled off. And how many more drilling locations do they have in the sweet spots? So as you move off of sweet spots into the much larger part of those plays that have much lower productivity wells, you're going to need a lot higher prices. So even if prices go up, you know, eventually it's going to get pretty hard to maintain production unless they go up a lot. So, you know, we'll see about that. But tight oil is, you know, it's a different beast than we've been dealing with some of these old conventional pools in Saudi Arabia, for example, or tar sands.
Okay. Just maybe one more question. Now, your report, it speaks to this huge disparity between the EIA's estimates and the actual production. And I'm kind of thinking that you've got the makings of some sort of a financial bubble there. You know, so I guess I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about what the implications of that might be. Like how would such the bursting of such a bubble, if that's accurate, express itself? And what could we look forward to on the financial markets as reality catches up with these apparently mistaken estimates?
Well, you know, a lot of tight oil production and shale gas production has been financed on debt. You know, a lot of these companies don't have much cash flow, if any, or negative cash flow. So they've been, you know, financing that production on debt. If prices go up a little bit, you know, in the short term, that will help things. They may be able to maintain production and, you know, plateau the production rate, stem the declines. But, you know, in the longer term, geology wins out every time. And, you know, as you move into those lower quality parts of the reservoir, you're going to need a lot higher prices to make it work. And if you don't have the prices, production's going to start to fall a lot, which is, you know, totally counterproductive to what Trump is telling us about energy independence in America. I think that's a real long shot. And if you look at Canada and, you know, Premier Notley's insistence that we need pipelines to Tidewater and so forth, you know, Premier Notley's problem is the price of oil. And, you know, we're dealing with expensive oil in the tar sands and expensive oil in terms of tight oil in the U.S. So, you know, it's going to be interesting in the longer term. But in the longer term, I think, you know, production is going to be difficult to maintain and prices are going to go a lot higher. And the U.S. is highly unlikely to be energy independent anytime soon.
Okay. Well, David Hughes, I want to thank you very much for sharing these thoughts with our audience.
Well, you're very welcome.
We've been joined by David Hughes, an earth scientist, the author of two recent reports on tight oil and gas production for the Post-Carbon Institute, and he himself is a fellow of the Post-Carbon Institute.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
Mark Rabinowitz is a Eugene-based writer, political activist, ecological campaigner, and permaculture practitioner. He publishes oilempire.us as well as jfkmoon.org. So he's been a past guest of the show, and about a year ago we spoke about the incoming Trump administration. And so we're going to have a one-year retrospective on the inauguration and what it forebodes for the future. So welcome back to the Global Research News Hour, Mark.
Thanks for the invitation.
So, yes, we've spoken on this show about this fracturing of what they call the deep state, which is an entity more or less encompassing elements of Wall Street as well as the intelligence apparatus of the U.S. There seemed to be a faction that favored Donald Trump and a faction that seemed to be favoring Hillary, and that we seem to be witnessing over the last year something of a war between them. Could I get your thoughts about what we know about those dual components of the ruling elite and what distinguishes them from each other?
Well, the different factions of the deep state, or as President Eisenhower called it, the military-industrial complex, have different tactical opinions over how to manage the empire. You have the Trump faction, victorious for now. It's worth remembering that former Vice President Dick Cheney endorsed Donald Trump's campaign, whereas the Bush family endorsed the Clinton campaign. And these are roughly comparable to the major factions. You have the powers that be that think that diplomacy should be used as a fig leaf for military adventurism, versus the neocons surrounded by Donald Trump. Michael Flynn was part of this, but he is gone, who think that naked aggression is a more appropriate response to global conditions.
Interesting.
But both agree that the U.S. should be dominant. They just have different approaches on how this should be done.
Hmm. Sort of like the fist in a velvet glove approach versus the baseball bat across the face approach.
Exactly.
Okay.
One major shift that few people seem to have predicted over the last year is the people surrounding Trump were not apparently as effective as one would expect an incoming presidential administration to be. The new book that's out by journalist Michael Wolff, Fire and Fury, made the assertion that the Trump campaign didn't actually expect to win the election, or win, quote-unquote, with voting machines, but regardless of what happened, they got the job. So that is a partial explanation why they were not ready to appoint officials in all different agencies and assistant and deputy undersecretaries and the whole bureaucracy, a reason that the administration has been somewhat chaotic, to put it politely.
Interesting. Well, when then did Trump become the chosen one? Because he wasn't the only Republican contender. Why was there this settling around Trump? Was that kind of like a late in the campaign decision because of the Democrats' Pied Piper strategy? Was there another Republican candidate who would have been chosen? I'm just wondering, when was it an 11th hour decision to hover behind Trump, or was this going back quite a distance?
Well, the Trump campaign tapped into a lot of discontent. that the Jeb Bush campaign was mercifully unable to access. And I think there were 17 different candidates for the Republican nomination, most of whom were not terribly serious. But the Trump campaign tapped into some clever discontent. They had very good media messaging, but there was a genuine sense of alienation among a lot of the Republican base, and for good reason. But picking Trump as the supposed solution for this, in some ways, to call it a bad joke is an understatement. There was also the problem of the Clinton campaign being a extremely dysfunctional response on the Democratic side. There are some who claim that Bernie Sanders would have done better, and I'm certainly sympathetic to that, but unfortunately, Sanders did not represent the type of point of view that the national security state would have been able to tolerate. So the idea that Sanders would have been a more viable candidate on the Democratic side, I don't find credible.
There's certainly a lot of good evidence that that Sanders won the Democratic or would have won the Democratic nomination if the DNC had been playing if it had been a fair fight and not weighted in favor of Hillary.
Maybe so, maybe not, but there would have been probably more media campaign against the socialist Bernie Sanders if he had done well in some of the bigger states. And then there were some states that perhaps the voting machines tipped the balance a couple of points. There are some who claim that happened in Massachusetts. But there are other states like California where it wasn't even close. And I'm certainly more sympathetic to Bernie Sanders than Hillary Clinton, but I don't think that either really had much of a message on the need to cut the military budget or recognize that we have reached the limits to growth on a finite planet, and therefore that changes all of our economic assumptions, including the messaging from the Sanders campaign.
Could you talk a little bit more about some of the individuals who are allied with each faction? I mean, you mentioned the Dick Cheney and Trump, Cheney supporting Trump, the neocons, as it were, but I mean, Robert Kagan, the author of The Project for a New American Century, is your quintessential neocon, it seems to me, and he was backing Hillary. George Herbert Walker Bush, a Republican, was backing Hillary, and John Negroponte, I don't know if it's, it seems a little bit, I'm a little bit unclear about some of these cleavages.
The Clinton campaign was certainly technologically competent. If the Clinton campaign had been given the job of president, they would have come into office making sure that all their various appointments would have been filled by competent technocrats. The Clintons had been in the White House before, and they were not going to wonder, where the light switches were in the room. They were well-placed to come into power and run as a well-oiled machine, whereas the Trump campaign really had very little idea what they were doing. Some of the neocons may have had some sympathy for some of the militarism behind the Trump campaign, but they also realized that Donald Trump is, to put it mildly, a loose cannon and not at all competent for the job, and in some ways even more dangerous due to this unfamiliarity with what he's supposed to do. And it won't surprise me if he is impeached or forced to resign under grounds of ill health or some similar excuse. But the national security state, the military-industrial complex, is not going to leave office if Trump is forced out of office or impeached if the Democrats take over the Congress at the end of this year.
Where does the sort of native or primitive nationalism fit into the picture? Because it sounds like you're, or at least the way it's generally portrayed, is the Clinton faction or the more globalist or global neoliberal oriented, and that Trump was, you know, I mean, a big factor for him was the criticism of trade deals like NAFTA, but, you know, along the lines of, you know, we need to make America great again, and getting rid of these trade deals would be a big panacea.
Well, the globalist, nationalist are labels that obscure some deeper truth, which is, you know, Trump has real estate deals all over the world. His Make America Great hats aren't even made in America. He is kowtowing towards numerous regimes all over the world for money laundering, for real estate deals. We could talk about Russia and what is or isn't true about that, and some of that has yet to come out. The Clintons clearly were in favor of NAFTA, but it's not like the people behind Trump didn't want corporate power in the financial system to be locked down at the border either. It's more of a pandering to parts of the United States that suffered greatly under NAFTA, as other parts of Canada and Mexico suffered in different ways under NAFTA. So it's not that they're calling for relocalization of production. It's more using it as an excuse to scapegoat.
So, yeah, you mentioned Russia. And, I mean, there's this big scandal, the infamous Russiagate scandal, which, you know, there have been plenty of you know, astute observers, veteran intelligence professionals for sanity, you know, people like Bill Binney and Raymond McGovern, who have you know, made very strong arguments that this whole Russiagate scandal is really just a pretense for taking down Trump, and that there's no substance to it. It's kind of like a modern day version of the weapons of mass destruction style deception, which facilitated the war in Iraq. What do you make of the whole Russiagate saga, and who's behind it and why?
Well, the aspect of it I find most interesting is a number of years ago, when Mr. Trump was only in real estate, he burned his bridges with U.S. banks because of his bankruptcy and poor business practices. He was blacklisted for getting more loans for his real estate scams and had to reach out to Russian money interests to finance some of his deals. I suspect whatever truth there is in the Russia story with Trump will be more about that than about hacking of the voting machines from Russia. If you look at the work of Greg Palast and others who have investigated election fraud in the United States, the voting machine scandal is more likely to come from Republican hackers than from the Russians, and that is an inconvenient truth which calls into question the legitimacy of so-called American democracy, which is a reason why the Democrats and the media, which is looking for an excuse to get rid of Trump before he blows up the world, is so far been unwilling to examine.
Hmm. Now, you're as convinced as ever, like, as, you know, maintained about a year ago when you're talking about peak blame, I think, that Trump is being installed effectively as a scapegoat to take the fall in the wake of a collapse of the economy. Is that, you know, that viewpoint hasn't changed much or has been reinforced?
Well, when you consider the functioning of the complex global industrial economy, it's ultimately rooted in the ability of physical resource flows more than digital dollars or digital euros or any other currency. Ones and zeros have their place, but it's the physical flow of stuff, and particularly of energy, that makes an economy possible. Conventional oil and gas has clearly passed its peak about a decade ago globally, and the main thing that's been holding the balance since has been what the geologists call unconventional fuels, tar sands in Canada, fracking in the United States, offshore oil and gas, which is much more energy intensive than the good stuff that was drilled decades ago. How long this can continue is a matter of some dispute among the geologists, and we'll see which ones turn out to be correct. But the bottom line is fracking delayed rationing. Fracking has probably peaked in the United States. It's barely being done anywhere else in the world, more due to geological problems than the fact that fracking is toxic and messy and expensive. And as fracking declines further, we are likely to see the arrival of permanent energy rationing. This may happen during the Trump administration. It may take longer than that. We'll see. But it's clearly on the horizon. The industry is well aware of this. And the military establishment, the smarter parts of it anyway, have been studying the potential for this for decades. If it wasn't for fracking, this would have come during the Obama administration, and he probably would have left office in disgrace rather than in relative triumph.
No, there was a recent article by the Russian-American engineer and commentator Dmitry Orlov that pointed out that 2017 was a massive disappointment for oil and gas exploration, with new discoveries only offsetting 11% of hydrocarbon production, which is unprecedented since the Second World War. So that's, and you know, we're seeing that sort of making an impact on the whole sanctions regime. I mean, what he was pointing to was that with all that glut created by fracking, that they seemed to think that, which pushed energy prices down, they thought that they could cripple and replace supplies coming from Gazprom in Russia. And today, or in fact, I think a couple of days from now, you're going to have a tanker of oil going to Boston from Gazprom. So much for, and like liquid natural gas is not going to offset Russian gas, no way. So the sanctions regime is probably going to turn into a tragic and embarrassing failure.
So, well, in the United States, conventional natural gas peaked in 1973, and since about 2000, conventional natural gas in the United States has dropped roughly in half, and now more than 60% actually, of U.S. natural gas is from fracking. Now, the Bernie Sanders campaign, for example, put a plank in the Democratic platform a year and a half ago saying that fracking needs to be stopped because it's toxic, it causes earthquakes due to the deep well injection, and has other problems for local communities who have to endure it in their neighborhoods, and this is true. But without fracked gas, cold communities such as Boston or Vermont or Chicago, Manitoba, Ottawa, Montreal, etc., are going to have a very difficult time keeping their cities warm in the winter. I've been using solar electric panels since 1990. They're great, but they're going to have a really difficult time being used to heat cold northern cities in the wintertime. And there is almost no discussion about this in the political system, and it's a looming challenge that not only is it not being worked on technically, but there's barely any consciousness that this is a looming threat to the continuity of our society.
There's no way to confront that threat in a way that's going to make certain people money.
Well, if cities become too cold to keep plumbing continuing, money will be the least of our problems.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we could reallocate the resources for endless war towards figuring out how to keep societies functioning on the energy downslope. Maybe that would work, maybe it would be too little too late. But this has not got any constituency on the left, on the right, on the Democratic side, the Republican side. Even the Green Party is not talking about it. Just like in Canada, it has virtually no political constituency either. One of the reasons I'm particularly interested in deep politics in the national security state is because the resources for our collective survival on planet Earth are locked up in the military-industrial complex. Most federal research and development in the United States goes for the war machine, as if we don't know how to commit war any better than we've figured out over the last several decades. And we need to shift the talent, the money, the physical resources towards things that will serve our great-grandchildren, as opposed to more ways to blow up the world. And I think we all know this at some level, some of us more than others, but the threats, the warmongering, plans for upgraded nuclear weapons that both Obama and Trump supported, these and other abnormal forms of domination are in the way of our collective response to the energy and environment crises that are the real threats to the 21st century.
The Professor Peter Dale Scott had pointed out in his writings that from 1961 to 1981, no American president had served a full two terms in office. And he indicated that this was related to efforts to govern and not just be a puppet of higher forces, you know, where there was some kind of a confrontation with the deep state, as it were. I definitely get the impression that Donald Trump is pushing the limits of what he's allowed to do as puppet in chief, hence the Russiagate and other scenarios. When you compare Trump with Presidents Kennedy through Carter, which presidential takedown seems to be the best indication of things to come?
Well, Carter or Nixon is probably more likely as a paradigm. Kennedy stood up to the national security state, as I'm sure you and your listeners know, whereas Trump is pushing for even more militarism than his predecessors, and is, he's not the first president to threaten nuclear war, but I think he is the first president to openly threaten nuclear war at the UN General Assembly, which he did last year, threatening to launch an attack on North Korea, which is incredibly dangerous. There's probably not language that describes how dangerous that is. If that happens, that upsets the apple cart for big business. If we have a nuclear war, all bets are off on what happens after that. Nixon is probably a better parallel, given that he overreached in some of his power, and the deep state removed him from office. One story that is actually somewhat reassuring in a bizarre way is, as Nixon was winding down in office, he became somewhat psychologically disturbed, and the military high command became concerned that he was thinking of launching a nuclear war out of spite. So the Secretary of Defense sent a message to the command saying, do not obey unusual orders from the White House, which translated into English meant, if Nixon orders the nukes to be launched, don't do it. So a couple weeks ago, Mr. Trump said that he had a big button on his desk that was more powerful than the one in Korea. My guess is if Trump spontaneously wakes up one day in a bad mood and orders an attack on North Korea, he might find his button doesn't actually work, that the military would refuse to follow his orders. This is speculation, and we hope that it never gets tested, but there's a limit to the power of any president, whether it's someone who is competent, like Kennedy, or someone who is incompetent, like Trump. In some ways, it's a ceremonial position, and the real power is held by the generals and the spies who do not leave office every 4 years.
I take it you don't recommend that activists side with either faction of the ruling elite or align themselves with Hillary-aligned social movements. How do you think responsible community members inside and outside America should capitalize or integrate the presidential drama with the task of sustaining a livable planet and a viable future?
Well, part of the problem is we are taught that the liberal side has to defeat the conservative side, or if you're on the conservative side, you need to defeat the liberal side. This party has to defeat that party. The whole us against the other side is part of the divide and conquer that keeps us from creating a society that has the potential to survive the challenges that we're faced with. So it's important to watch the unfolding drama of Trump versus the Democrats versus the Republicans versus this versus that. But regardless of that, we all are going to have to meet our community's needs more locally, on the neighborhood level, on the regional level. These are places where you're more likely to make an impact than hoping that a distant politician in another time zone will respond to your Facebook petition or whatever. So here in Oregon, we have done a lot more of this than most states in the country, yet we grow 5% of our food. When I've been in Canada, I've been astounded to see that most of the grocery stores I've gone into have most of their food from the United States of America. The more we relocalize production, that we build community resilience, that we learn to transcend some of the philosophical differences that keep neighbors from working cooperatively together, the more resilient we will be not only against energy disruptions and climate disruptions, but we will be less subject to distant political decisions that try to control the way we live.
Mark Rabinowitz, I really appreciate the way you frame these big picture topics, both in this conversation and on your websites. I want to thank you very much for this check-in, and hope to have another conversation with you soon.
Can I just add one final
thought? Of course.
Which is, when Trump gave a speech to the UN a couple months ago calling for a war against North Korea, it reminded me of Kennedy's second and final speech to the UN in 1963, where he called off the Cold War and the arms race and urged a globally cooperative trip to the moon with the Soviet Union. And I recommend your listeners to listen and read this at my website, jfkmoon.org, because that shows some of the potential that if we had good leadership and backed by an aware public, we could use our resources for endless war towards peaceful cooperation on our round, finite planet.
Well said. Mark Rabinowitz, thank you very much.
Thanks again.
That was Mark Rabinowitz, Eugene-based writer, political activist, and ecological campaigner, and permaculture practitioner, publisher of, as you just heard, jfkmoon.org, and also the site oilempire.us.
We'll hear more on the one-year anniversary of Trump's inauguration next week. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.